I just recently deleted all of my social apps on my phone. Yeah, I really sort of urge everybody to kind of do that because, you know, it's just, it's killing us, you know, like as a society. We just got to, move on, or at least kind of simplify and get back to basics, which again is sort of like, that's sort of the beauty of the timepiece, of the watch. You know, it's sort of like, this is as basic as it can get.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. I was able to grab Ben to talk through a whole bunch of things that have been going on in the Hodinkee universe this past week. It started off last Monday. We published our first ever book. We published it in partnership with Asseline. It's called Watches, A Guide by Hodinkee. And it was really a team effort. Everyone on the editorial team banded together to write what we think is a really great kind of primer about watches. It's something, if you're a diehard, you can find new things. If you're somebody who knows nothing about watches, this is about as good a first step you can take. We also then talked about some stories that we published over the past week, everything from the release of the new 007 James Bond watch from Omega to an undiscovered astronaut watch that our friend Jeff Stein found to some pre-auction coverage. Ben and I kind of dive a little deeper into the auction catalog, getting past what you would initially think of as the highlights. Then we've got my conversation with Mark Thorpe. Mark's an artist, he's an architect, he's a designer, he's somebody who's kind of hard to pin down. He thinks really deeply about things, but in a totally unpretentious way, he's a ton of fun to talk to, and he's somebody I've wanted to have on the show for a while. He's actually been mentioned on the show before, so we thought it was time to get him in the studio and hear from him firsthand. So without further ado, let's go. This week's episode is presented by Timex. Stay tuned later in the show for my conversation with Giorgio Galli, designer of the new Timex S1. For more, visit timex.com. Hey, man. Good to see you.
Hey, dude. How are you?
Good. It's a busy week.
This is like old WeWork days.
Just I know. Stevie and Ben hanging out. Just the two of us, man. It's old school Hodinkee. Except on the other side of the glass, we've got 35 people working away
on this floor. Yeah. Another 10 or 12 upstairs. Yeah, we've got it's Ben and Steven and then like 50 other people.
Exactly. Can you imagine if we tried to cram them into the WeWork?
I feel like there's a bet there somewhere.
There's definitely a bet,
right?
We should get some money from Frank for that, right?
Yeah. Frank is our ad sales guy, by the way.
Shout out to Frank. We're gonna take your money.
Frank and little Frank has a little baby named Frank who's adorable
also. Yeah, true. And Frank's dad is also Frank, so.
And his father's
lots
well.
Of Franks. This is Franks, the Frank cast. For the record,
he's gonna love it.
Cool. So it's been a busy week here. We're recording this Friday morning. It's kind of gray and calm outside, which is strange because in here it's like kind of chaos. But we started the week off with a big announcement. We did our first book.
We sure did.
Can you tell us? So the book is A Guide to Watches.
Yeah.
We did it with Asseline. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about like how this came about? Because I think a lot of people probably don't understand like how a book happens.
Yeah, I mean, books can happen any number of ways. They can be written on spec. There can be an advance and a deal. The way that this happened was somebody from Asseline had reached out to us, and we've been in touch with them several times over the years. Asseline, for those who don't know, is the eminent publisher of like the most beautiful art books and coffee table books in the world. They're the Patek Philippe of coffee table books, for sure. And so, you know, we were honored to be contacted by them. Kara and I met with them and said, hey, you know, we want to do this book. We want to do something that is appealing to as many people as possible, but also have enough kind of like little knowledge bombs in there to make it compelling to our core audience, which is you guys who's certainly listening to us today on the pod. And that's exactly what we did. And I think what was really important for me when I started to think about what this idea was to make sure that all of our editors, all of our full-time editors, would have a byline. And so all of our editors, from myself even to even you, Stephen, even you get a
even
one.
Me, yeah. Even you're, I got to write a book.
Even yeah. Even Stephen, although even Stephen, yeah. Even Stephen wrote a chapter on dress watches. He, of course, penned his own book last year with yeah. Jan Stone. Jack has written a book or two in the past. But everyone else, it was their inaugural run as a published author in, you know, for a book anyway, not you know, just not only in print and magazine. So it was a really compelling idea, and I'm happy to say we executed it really quickly. You know, there are
yeah.
some photographs that made their way from kind of like test runs from our magazine, but the majority of the images were actually shot for this book by us, yeah. in some cases with some help with some friends from Asselin and elsewhere. But it's just a really neat thing. And again, it's a timeless thing, just like our magazine, where, you know, you'll be able to pick this thing up in 10 years, 20 years, and enjoy it the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just talking to the team here and thinking, you know, to a year ago when I published what was my first book, was the feeling of having your name on a book is it's a cool thing.
It's a really cool thing.
Even in 2019, it where is. We're all digital all the time, it's a cool thing.
It is. And I mean, you know, books, I mean, you know, we try to make our magazines just as lasting as books. And in many cases, I'd say they are.
Yeah.
But I mean, this, you know, it's harder cover. It'll be distributed through all of Asselin's points of sale. So they're, you know, they're boutiques. They're in several of the most beautiful hotels there are, things like that. It's a wonderful moment for us to kind of celebrate all that we've accomplished over the last 10 years and all that we seek to accomplish, you know, moving forward. And yeah, it's a special thing. I mean, a book is a neat thing. And it's one of those things where, look, I mean, we're an atypical digital brand, right? Like, we started digital, yeah. we're e-commerce. We're going to do retail in the coming year. We're doing a book. Like, we believe in the is that a word?
Tactility? Yeah, tactility. Yeah.
Okay, well, tactility of things. Like, you know, holding this book in your hand like that feels really good.
Yeah,
as somebody that, you know, spends his days holding watches in his hand, you know, it feels very much the same way.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, you touched on it, but I think one of the things I really like about this book is how approachable it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, there's a chapter on chronographs. There's a chapter on the history of watches. There's a chapter on military watches, on iconic watches, complications. Like, it's a thing where there's kind of something for everyone.
Yeah.
And it's also all tied back to pop culture. So it's something that we always try to do on the web, in the magazine, and of course in this book, is like, these aren't just watches sitting in a case under a microscope or a loop. This is watches on people's wrists out in the real world. So you'll see those photos of Paul Newman. You'll see those photos of Steve McQueen, of Rudolph Valentino, and you know, Jackie Kennedy, to get a sense of like how these things exist in the world, which I think, you know, for us, makes watches more appealing to new people. And and that's something exciting. Like, I always get excited when somebody can pick up our magazine and says, like, I didn't even know watches were a thing, but like, I'm kind of into it now.
Yeah. And I think that's, and I actually say this in the opening of the book, I mean, our goal has always been to get more people excited about this field than ever before. And with this book, as you mentioned, Stephen, like, the goal is to get younger guys and gals and just new people excited about what this field means. And that could be something very technical. It could be the engineering aspect of getting to the moon, which is something that, you know, we've talked about a lot, but we talk about again here. And then just, you know, the elegance of, you know, Jackie Kennedy wearing her Cartier, or Gianni Agnelli wearing his Patek World Timer over his, you know, suit jacket. I mean, like, these are just epically beautiful moments in pop culture. And, you know, Asselin can kind of like put a lens on moments like that better than anybody.
Yeah, I totally agree. So, so the book is out. It's available on the Hodinkee shop. It's available through Asselin's retailers. It's called Watches, A Guide by Hodinkee. We'll link it up in the show notes. Go check it out. I think, you know, if you're listening to this, you'll probably enjoy it.
I'm thinking you'll probably like it.
Yeah, I think you'll probably like it. Yeah.
It's called Watches. And so if you like watches, you're going to like it.
That's a good ad right there. Yeah. cool. So
this episode brought to you by Watches.
Exactly. Just brought to you by Watches.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we did that on Monday, but then we also published a whole ton of great stories this week, despite the fact that about half our editorial team was traveling and in various corners of the globe this week. But we published some really great stuff. Speaking of pop culture tie-ins, you know, one of the biggest stories was about the new James Bond watch, the Seamaster Diver 300 meters 007 edition.
007, yeah. And as some of you more diehard listeners may recall, I was actually in Italy to see a filming, as part of the filming of the latest Bond film, and I got to see the watch back then. I couldn't talk about it, but I saw it back then. It's the best Bond watch they've ever done.
Agreed.
No question about it. It is full titanium. The mesh bracelet is amazing. It wears wonderfully, broad arrow, military insignia. Like, they really paid attention on this one. And what's neat about this one is that it is limited production, but not limited edition.
Yeah.
So that's something that always kind of comes up with the Bond stuff. It's like, okay, like, is 7,007 units really limited? What's funny is it actually is, because I remember somebody at Omega very high up telling me that they did 7,000 units of not the last one, the one before, and they had 25,000 people that wanted to buy it. So, I mean, that means you're that turning away a lot of money, right? You're turning around like 14,000-15,000 people from or more from buying this $7,000 watch. So what they're doing with this one is, you know, they're going to trickle it out, you know, a lot like they do with other products, not like many brands do with other products. Like, it's going to be difficult to get for sure, but it's going to be around for a little while. I would guess at least until the next Bond film. I don't know that. But they nailed it. I mean, again, you know, I'm a fan of the one from Spectre as well. I, in fact, have one of those watches in titanium, the Seamaster 300.
Yeah.
This one is, it feels like the watch that Bond should be wearing for sure.
Yeah. So it's a Seamaster 300. It's got that helium escape valve up at 10 o'clock, but it's titanium. It's super lightweight. The bracelet, like you said, is awesome. The case back engravings are also really cool.
Yeah.
I'm really into it. It's got these kind of like, it's got that broad arrow, and then it has what look like essentially military serial numbers.
Right. And it's /62, right? So 62 is, of course, the year that Dr. No, the first James Bond film, came out.
Yeah. It's a super cool thing. I mean, I think Omega's really paying attention. I mean, we've talked about this before, but like, they care what the enthusiasts care about, and that's a cool thing. It's nice to see a watch brand really say, like, okay, we want to listen to our customers, and we want to have that kind of like two-way interaction instead of just like handing people a group of watches every year and saying, like, take it or leave it.
Yeah.
One thing that people did question is the price on this watch. It's a little bit higher than on previous Bond watches.
How priced, much is it?
It's $9,200 US on the bracelet.
Yeah.
Which, sure, it's a little bit more than some of the Bond watches, but I have to say, having seen it in the metal, like, that feels totally appropriate.
It does, and I think if you also consider the fact that it's completely titanium. So titanium is much harder to work with. It's much rarer in the watch world. You know, I mean, speaking about the watch that I currently own, you know, the Seamaster 300 in titanium, that's 9,000, right?
Right.
The same watch in steel is 6,800. You know, so I mean, there is that premium of working with titanium, and the titanium of the Bond watch is this mesh bracelet, which I would imagine, I don't know, but I would imagine would be very difficult to make. So, you know, I think it's really easy to assume that, like, there's this premium because of Bond or whatever. My guess is it's more associated with the materials. I mean, we saw it when we did our IWC with Ceratanium. Like,
right.
That costs money, you know? Like, you know, right. to do it in steel is easy, but, like, to do it with a material that, like, basically nobody uses, like, that stuff, like, you know, you have to remachine stuff. You have to retool stuff. And titanium, you know, Omega doesn't use titanium for that much stuff. So, like, you know, it's just, you know, I mean, people get how this stuff works, but like, there are economies of scale. If you're doing
of course.
Like fewer products in titanium, it's gonna cost more.
Yeah, totally. You know, one of the, I'm looking at the article we published that James shot and wrote for us, and styled with like a camel colored sweater and like a chambray shirt. Like, this watch is mean looking.
Yeah,
man.
No,
it's super cool.
It's people are gonna like it. And you know, we've seen it in the metal. We had it here in the office the other day for James to shoot. It's solid. Like, it's gonna be a seller for sure.
And it's the Bond 25 watch.
Indeed, B25.
Yeah. So I think long term there might be some collectability here too.
I think so.
So we have a different kind of like cool guy watch that was written about. Our friend Jeff Stein from On the Dash.
Jeff Stein's the coolest guy I know.
Jeff Stein's the man.
Yeah,
he is, you know, the man. Jeff occasionally texts me and is just like, "Hey, I have an idea for a story. You guys interested?"
Yeah, it'll be 4,000 words.
Yeah, but invariably, it's about something awesome that I had like no idea existed.
That is the position that Jeff Stein occupies in most of our lives.
Yeah.
So for those of you who don't know Jeff, I would imagine many do. He's the founder of On the Dash, which is the Hoyer Forum. He is a Harvard-educated attorney, you know, world-class lawyer down in Atlanta. He runs several miles a day. He's a Mini Cooper collector. He's a diehard baseball fan. Like, the guy can do anything. He really can, including discover some amazing watches.
Yeah, and so we've been talking about this story, he and I, for, I guess, probably a year now, about the watches of John Glenn, the astronaut, the first American to orbit the Earth.
Yeah.
Basically as cool as it gets,
I would say.
And we've been trying to figure out how to do it. And then, you know, a couple of John Glenn's watches are coming up for sale at Phillips next week, which is something we'll talk about more in a minute. Mm-hmm. But we decided now was the right time. So Jeff wrote this amazing in-depth story for us. We'll link it up in the show notes about his hunt for John Glenn's watches.
Yeah.
So John Glenn passed away, and his family decided to sell everything through an estate sale.
Yeah.
Like, he was just like some guy living in suburban America.
Yeah. Was it Baltimore or somewhere?
I think
there.
So. Yeah. And watches were included. So instead of going to Phillips or Christie's or Sotheby's to sell these things, they just sold them for like all things considered, not a ton of money.
Right. Like on a like on John Glenn's table, like in his living room.
Yeah, yeah. And Jeff was able to buy some watches.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we said, a couple are coming up for auction, but not Jeff's. And one of the watches he discovered is a watch that we didn't know existed before. Mm. It's a 24-hour dial Le Coultre watch. And it's just like, it's an unknown astronaut watch.
Yeah, and what's amazing is, well, there's so many amazing things about this story. The first is that the Glenn family just decided to sell everything via, like, some random estate company in suburban Maryland, we'll say. and that just goes to show you, like, that this can still happen. Like, John Glenn is, like, an actual American. Like, he's a worldwide hero, but certainly in the U.S.
For sure.
And, like, these watches, in particular the Breitling, have, like, real value, like, tangible value. And so I've got many thoughts about this. The idea that somebody found this and bought it and is now selling it via Phillips is a bit of a bummer. Like, you kind of wish that watch had gone to somebody that just loved John Glenn and would keep it forever. I totally understand. Like, this is just triage. Somebody bought it for a very low dollar amount and will now sell it for a very high dollar amount. It is what it is. Happens all the time.
Sure.
Wish it had a different story, but c'est la vie. But I think, you know, as you mentioned, Stephen, what was so amazing about Jeff's story is that he discovered not only a new astronaut watch, but a watch that was issued, right? Like NASA issued these 8 Le Coultre watches, 7 to the Mercury 7 astronauts, and then I think an additional 8th to the administrator of the program. And this is a new fact. And, like, you know, shame on us. We kind of buried the lead there in some ways. Like, Jeff's story is so complete and so amazing. But, like, this is big news in the watch world. The fact that Le Coultre was producing a watch for NASA with a special dial, 24-hour dial. I assume the movement was a 24-hour movement as well. It wouldn't just be a standard movement. And, like, there are photos of him wearing this watch with Jack Kennedy. There's a photo of his colleague Scott Carpenter wearing one, I think, on the cover of Time or Life or something.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, it's really, this is wild. And I think everybody assumed that this watch was just like a personal object of any one of these astronauts, but they were in fact issued by NASA. Pre-Speedmaster, of course. I mean, you know, very different watch than the Speedmaster. But I think that's just an amazing thing. And, you know, it would be Jeff Stein to discover something like this.
Yeah, of course it would be,
But pretty neat thing. And, you know, what's amazing is I don't think Jeff has reached out to Jaeger just yet. Maybe we should help him do that on his behalf.
Yeah, that's probably true.
We can get access to the archives and see what the real story is with these watches. But it's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. So if you haven't read the story by now, go check it out. If you're listening to this on the website, it'll be down below. If you're listening to it on your phone, check it out in the show notes. This is really like a can't-miss story.
Yeah, it's also a neat follow-up to Cole Pennington's The Watch That Came In From the Cold. I mean, it's got similar vibes to that.
Yeah, it does, actually. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, airman type of thing for the U.S. military or whatever.
That's true.
You know, it's a neat follow-up for sure.
Yeah. So going on to the auctions, you know, like we said, this Le Coultre isn't coming up for auction, but...
But another one that looks a lot like it is.
Yeah.
That was from John Glenn's estate.
True.
The Lucky 13 watch.
The Lucky 13 watch. So this watch, I wrote a story that published just a few hours ago. So, you know, by the time you're listening to this last week. And it's this really strange gold cap or gold fill watch where all of the numerals are 13.
Lucky 13.
It was presented to him by the Anti-Superstition Society of Chicago.
That's a thing.
On Friday the 13th in 1962, just a couple months after he orbited the Earth. And kind of the tie-in here is that his capsule that he orbited in was capsule number 13. So for John Glenn, 13 became a lucky number for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And so this watch is just like, it's a really strange little like weird piece of history.
But it was his watch.
And it was his watch.
What's neat also is that, so the Phillips auction takes place next week, and next Friday is Friday the 13th.
True story. So if you buy this watch, you could wear it on Friday the 13th.
You probably should. And if you do, you let us know. We'll put it on our Instagram.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, if you are listening to this and then buy the watch, definitely hit us up.
Yeah.
But some of the other watches in the sale outside of John Glenn's watches, you know, I looked through the catalog, and there's also, you know, the Brando watch and the Nicholas watch, which... You know, I guess while we're talking about them, like what are you anticipating for those watches?
I think pretty big numbers. I mean, it's Phillips, it's New York, it's the time when people want to spend some money, you know? And I think, you know, these two guys, you know, this is not Paul Newman, so don't even, you know, let's not talk about $20 million or even 10. But I think, you know, Marlon Brando, and this is an incredibly iconic, you know, film, one of, you know, top 10, I would say.
Yeah, of course.
That and Jack Nicklaus is you know, if you're into golf, he's Michael Jordan of golf, you know? Yeah. I mean, much more so than Tiger Woods. Like, he holds the most majors of anybody.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of the great athletes of the 20th absolutely. Century.
I mean, you know, he has been right up there. He sat next to Muhammad Ali at, I think, ESPN's Athletes of the Century. Like, it's, you know, right. This is real stuff, yeah. You know? So, I, you know, and the golf community is a famously wealthy one, which is true. Why Rolex, Omega, et cetera, advertise so heavily there. I would expect a serious result from that. You know, we obviously just kind of discovered the watch with the Talking Watches 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And in chats with Jack, you know, he had asked my opinion on what he should do with it. And I said, donate it, you know, put it up at auction, donate it for charity with Phillips, of course. I would have loved to see the opportunity to play with Jack.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was like, you know, I don't know. And then, you know, this is kind of behind the scenes stuff. You know, when we were down in his house filming, he said, well, what about Augusta? Like, what if I played around at Augusta with the winner of the watch? And I was like, at that point, it could be a $10 million watch, you know,
right.
To play Augusta, which for those of you who don't know, golf is like, it's Mecca, you know, it's not the number one golf course on the planet, but it is certainly the most difficult to get onto. And it's where they hold the Masters every year. Jack won the Masters, I think, 6 times, like, he's the guy. So to be able to play Augusta, period, and people have paid $1 million just to play Augusta. So to play it with Jack Nicklaus, who's won the Masters more than anybody, with the watch would be, I mean, it would be beyond. Unfortunately, that's not the case.
So we've just talked about an awesome thing that is not happening.
It should have happened. Yeah. You know, and again, I'm sure there's issues with this idea. Otherwise, it would have happened. But yeah, the watch on its own with a full, like the full amount goes to Jack's charity down in Florida. I believe Phillips takes nothing on it as they typically do. You know, I think this will do really well. I mean, you know, I know some folks in the golfing community that are really excited about it. And then, you know, I think we're talking 7 figures for both of them, but who knows? You know?
I agree. What I originally wanted to talk about, though, were some of the, like, lesser-known watches.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that struck me flipping through the catalog was there are a handful of sealed Pateks in the sale, which you really don't see too often anymore.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, when you buy a Patek Philippe watch, there are 2 seals on it, like when it leaves the factory, right? There's an outer seal on the box. It's this little piece of blue tape with a bunch of, like, Calatrava crosses on it. That's the quality control seal. So once that goes on, that means it's ready for sale. And then the watch, when it's finished by the watchmakers, is put in this sealed sort of like plastic, almost like vacuum pouch. Mm-hmm. So you can have a Patek can be open. It can be single sealed where the bag is intact, but the blue tape has been broken. Or it can be double sealed where both the bag and the blue tape are intact.
Yeah.
There's a couple of single sealed watches in the sale, mm-hmm. which is cool because you, in theory, can't get sealed watches anymore.
Correct. You know, now, just like with Rolex, like Rolex used to sell you a watch, or the dealers would sell you a watch with the warranty card blank.
Right.
That does not occur anymore.
No.
Period. for obvious reasons. Patek, as Stephen just said, you can no longer take your watch home sealed. It was common for 5970s, split seconds, stuff like that, to be sealed because, like, it's basically just money in the bank. You put it in the back of your safe and then sell it down the road.
Or right.
No longer the case. We want, you know, brands want people to wear their watches. So, yeah, the 5950 that you called out in the story, I mean, that's among my favorite modern watches, period. People do not understand the difference between that and the 5370, which is also a favorite.
Yeah.
The 5370 is an amazing thing, but it's basically a 5170 with a split-second module built on top.
Right.
What happens with the 5950 is this is a fully integrated, super slim split-second. I mean, it is just, it's a different level. I mean, it's really 2 to 3 levels above. It is also 2 to 3 times more expensive.
Correct.
I mean, this is like a $400,000 or $500,000 retail watch.
Can you explain the watch to people, just in case people don't know what watch we're talking
about?
Yeah,
so it's a rectangular split mono pusher split second chronograph inspired by a watch from, I think, the 30s that we actually have photos of on the site.
Yeah.
And it's in stainless steel. They now do it in gold as well. It's got these kind of like deco-y, kind of like weird, you know, Gary Getz calls it the cowboy watch because it's almost like a Western theme.
Yeah, it's like these scrolling
kind of weird things. Not my favorite, to be honest with you, but the watch is epic. I mean, and this is a sleeper. This is not like, everybody knows, not everybody, but many people know what a 5970, you know, 5004R, stuff like that. They know how much they cost. Most people do not understand what this watch is. I've loved it for many years because I love chronographs. I love splits. It's so slim and it's steel. And it's not a 5970. So people don't really know or appreciate kind of how special it is, but it is far more rare, far more special, and far more interesting than anything else.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the estimate on this guy is 160 to 320.
Slow.
I was going to say that feels really low to me.
I'm a buyer all day at 160.
You are know? You? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a watch that, I mean, not really actually, but I have no money. But, you know, if I had money at 160, that is a no brainer. I mean, yeah. that's half the price of retail probably.
Right.
You know, I think retail's in the fours and it is worth, you know, if you're a lover of real high end watchmaking, like the best of the best, this is it. And I think, you know, Patek, in many ways, has been getting kind of a bum rap recently because of all the Nautilus stuff. Like, this is not their doing, you know. And when, you know,
yeah.
there are other people that I would say make better watches below, say, $150,000 to $200,000, Lange being chief among them. Vacheron's right up there. Like, Vacheron is just as high quality as any Patek for sure. But once you get to that $400,000 to $500,000 range, which I know sounds ridiculous,
it's all right.
Patek comes into a league of their own. They have so many SKUs that nobody talks about because they're all application pieces. They're not in stores, they're not anywhere. They almost don't even communicate about them at Basel. They blow people away. And, you know, the 5950 is chief among them for me.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Nautilus craziness, and that was another one that struck me here. Is there the first lot of this sale, like Phillips is going to come right out of the gate and sell a sealed 5711A.
Yeah.
It's estimated at 20,000 to 40,000, which is like a complete joke of an estimate.
Yeah. That's retail, right? And retail's like 30 grand.
Right. Yeah. Like, what do you think this goes for?
Know.
Like, I have no idea.
It's I don't pay attention to this market because I just don't care. But yeah. I know like a lot of my friends do, and they've told me things have softened a little bit. It all depends on what this person wants to do with it. If you want to wear it, you know, I think 60. You know, if you want to sit on it, 70. You know, I think, you know, not anything more than that would be extreme. But it'll do well, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, I know people that are paid in the 60s for these watches. Yeah. I think what is more interesting about the Nautilus offerings in this sale is that they've got two 5711Ps.
Yeah, that was going to be my next one.
Yeah, the anniversary watch, which is diamond markers, you know, 40th anniversary stamped right on the dial. And then to me, kind of the holy grail of modern Nautiluses, which is the unstamped, the non-anniversary 5711P,
yeah.
Of which there are, you know, really a handful known. So there's, I think both those watches, the non-40th anniversary one will fly. These do not come up for sale. That watch in platinum on your wrist is amazing.
I'd actually never seen one in the metal.
Yeah.
I'd seen the anniversary ones.
Yeah.
I'd never seen the plain 5711P.
It's such a baller
thing. It is so cool, man. Oh, man.
Again, that is like, you know, instead of buying that, I bought the rose gold one, which I love.
Yeah.
And that's a great watch. I'll never sell it. But the P would have been something special for sure. But, you know, it was literally double the price. And I was like, well, you know, who needs this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Going away from Patek for a second, a watch that you have sung you've sung its praises pretty highly over the last couple weeks, the Erwerk AMC, the Atomic Erwerk.
Yeah, so I was really wrong at the Grand Prix, right?
Yeah, it's all right. Anything, it's fine. But they've got one of these.
Yeah.
It's estimated at 1 to 2 million. Mm-hmm. It's number one.
Yeah.
Erwerk said they're only going to make three.
Right.
This is number one. It's the first one to come up for sale. I'll be really curious to see what interest is on this.
Yeah.
It's actually selling right after the 5950A. Mm-hmm. It's a lot eight. It's pretty early in the sale. It'll be kind of an interesting moment, I think, in the auction.
Yeah,
since
I agree.
So weird.
It's a weird thing, but it is an amazing thing, as I've said many times.
Agreed.
I'm curious about the consignment of this one. Like, did this come from somebody who bought it and then sold it, or is this coming directly from Erwerk?
I think it's coming from Erwerk. I would have to check.
I would guess so.
But I think it's coming from Erwerk.
That would make more sense because I just can't see somebody buying something this strange and then selling it this quickly. But that would be interesting to know for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's one of the coolest things made in the past 10 years of watchmaking, truly. It's not my, you know, it's not my aesthetic. It's like a little bit too Iron Man-y, like Tony Stark-y for me. But it's an amazing thing. And, you know, if they could, if like Laurent Ferrier could style this product, I'd be all about it. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Yeah.
So you want an atomic clock watch, but that looks like a super classic watch.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
You could probably, you know, a couple guys, you could probably get that made.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, probably.
Yeah.
Again, it's the money thing.
This is like
what, a $1 to $2 million estimate?
Yeah. $1 to $2 million estimate.
That's
a
lot.
I'll be very curious to see what the bidding on this is like, because there's got to be like three guys who actually want to own this, but they've got to really want it.
You
got
to really want it.
Yeah.
You got to really want it. Yeah.
Cool. I mean, there's a bunch of other cool stuff in this catalog. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. The sale's Tuesday night in New York, 5 p.m. Eastern. We're going to be covering it live, but you should go check the catalog out. I think, you know, for me, this is one of those sales where the Brando watch and the Nicholas watch kind of like drowned everything else out.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a shame because I think this is actually one of the more interesting Phillips catalogs in a while.
Yeah, I really like the New York sales because there's a little bit less fanfare. It's a little bit more pure in my humble opinion. There's some great watches there. Like, you know, what I'm really seeing an uptick in interest in vintage Patek. You know, Rolex was just so intense and so full on for so many years now. It's just like, all right, like kind of enough, you know? How many gilt GMTs are you going to see? How many blueberries are you going to see or whatever, you know? And so like they've got some killer, you know, I'm not talking crazy money watches, but expensive certainly. Like they've got a beautiful 565 that looks dead mint with luminous hands, luminous dial. Unpolished case. They've got a 530 chronograph, which I've been intending to write about for like 3 weeks and just never have. It's a great watch. You know, rare stuff that, like, to me, when you put, you know, let's say the 530 sells for 200 grand, like, put that next to a Paul Newman, like, 530 every day of the week, no question about it. 565 is probably, you know, 50 to 60 grand, maybe more, because of the condition. Put that next to, I don't know, you know,
a gilt sub.
Like, are you kidding me? Like, it's not, you can't even compare, you know? And I know that that watch is cool because it's steel, so you can wear that just like a Rolex. It doesn't have the same kind of perceived wearability, but like, I've owned 565s. You can put them on, you know, a pizza rice bracelet and wear them every day.
Yeah.
So I would encourage people to take a look at those lots for sure.
Yeah. Also, I mean, it is super high end. It's, I think, the highest estimated lot in the sale. The Pink on Pink 1518.
That's amazing.
Ooh, man.
I mean that's a grail watch. I don't know this. I haven't really done my homework. Is this like a new watch? Is this a fresh to market?
I haven't actually. I didn't look that deep into the catalog, but we'll have to take a look. But it's a pretty amazing piece.
Look, I mean, 1518 is, you know, ask John Goldberger if he could have one watch, I would almost guarantee he'd say 1518. In fact, I think he may have said that to us in the past. You know, it is everything that a vintage watch should be, and pink gold alone is amazing, and then pink dial, like, you know, that's a sexy thing. Again, we're talking very limited buyer group here because this is going to be a multi-million dollar watch.
Yeah, it's 1.2 to 2.4 is the estimate.
So, and the people that want them probably already have them, but, you know, we'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, man. We'll wait and see what the auctions hold next week, and we'll have you back soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Up next, my conversation with designer and architect Mark Thorpe.
We should record this. Are we recording?
We are recording.
Some of that could be good.
Yeah,
that's fun.
No, it's good to see you though.
Yeah, no, thank you, man.
Yeah,
no, this is super
cool. You've been traveling around the world too, right?
Yeah, I mean, always. I mean, you know, I try to move around as much as possible. Yeah, typically it's normally work related, you know. Last week I was in Venice.
Okay.
Udine and Poland, just kind of like moving around, just working on stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Did you avoid the floods in Venice?
Yeah, ironically it was like we were on Murano working with Vanini and also this other company, Nizam Reddy, and they were developing some product there, and the waters started to rise just as we were kind of leaving.
Okay.
The weather got kind of a little shittier, so we were fortunate that we were able to kind of get everything that we needed to do there with everybody and hang out before the shit hit the fan.
Yeah.
Can you curse on this thing?
Yeah, you can curse. That's fine. Yeah.
That's fine. It won't be too aggressive, but
yeah, no, that's fine. This is an, I would say, all ages ish podcast.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it's all right. I think we've had one episode that got an explicit tag, courtesy of Ben, but
perfect.
I think that's the only one.
Perfect. We'll avoid as much as possible.
It's all right. If the boss man's doing it, it's
mm-hmm.
okay.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you were in Venice working with some partners. Can you explain maybe a little bit what you do for people who might not understand what it means to be a designer, which I'm putting in scare quotes?
Well, you know, honestly, like, you know, I was having this conversation earlier around this notion of like defining myself as a designer or even an architect. And honestly, like, I'm really kind of falling more into this camp of just sort of, I mean, and I don't know how arrogant this might sound, but this, you know, kind of leaning more towards just being an artist. You know, because the work is really coming from like the soul in so many ways. You know, like every project that's worked on is typically a passion project. You know, versus working to pay bills or to facilitate studio or make payroll or any of that stuff. So in a lot of ways, I'm starting to lean away a little bit from calling myself just a designer or an architect or what have you, you know, and creative also is sort of a bit ambiguous to me. You know, you kind of hear a lot of that talk in like agencies, you know, it's like, there's the ECD and like this stuff. It's like, well, what does that mean? You know? So I don't know. I've kind of like sort of, for me personally, kind of positioned myself a little bit more in terms of like, almost like an actor, or, you know, like I always thought it was, you know, like we were always, it was a little bit of a joke, but it was sort of like, you know, like what would it be like if you were like Daniel Day-Lewis of design, you know, or something like that, you just kind of show up and randomly become a table. Yeah. And then you like design something and then you leave, you know, and then you kind of like fade away for a little bit and you come back and do something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like something along those lines was kind of interesting to me.
But that speaks to how diverse your work is, right? Like you're not somebody who makes just lighting or just furniture or just buildings, right? Like you kind of do everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know how good or bad that is, you know? I mean, obviously if you specialize in something, you know, like people will come to you specifically for that. Mm. So I think by having that sort of multidisciplinary approach, you know, sort of lends yourself a little bit more towards, you know, like trying to, you know, keep it more personal and, you know, more specific.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, like for me, I was always more interested in developing relationships, you know, like even this right now is actually really nice. And this relationship, by the way, comes from, Innie Archibong, who I'd like to just sort of like plug
shout out to Innie.
You know, cause Innie is a longtime friend, and so, you know, I just want to thank him for letting this happen, because I've been a huge fan of Houdinki. Oh. So also thank you for allowing this opportunity to be here with you guys. But yeah, for me it was, you know, my interest in terms of design or any sort of, you know, creative facet of that world is really sort of based in relationships and sort of developing those. You know, which is a little bit of more of a long-term understanding of things, you know. Yeah. It's about people, you know.
Yeah.
Like ultimately.
Yeah.
And it's not about producing stuff, you know. Like I don't have that many things produced, you know, like, you know, at 41 now, but ultimately it's like, you know, the stuff that is produced is very specific to me. It's a personal sort of story.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that I worked with, you know, are directly tied to those pieces. It's almost like the products are actually byproducts. They're byproducts of a relationship that sort of occurred and happened.
Yeah.
You know, versus just designing for design's sake, which again sort of sets me apart in so many ways, you know. So I don't know how financially you know, good that is, but in terms of running a business, but you know, at least I got integrity, you know. No, I'm kidding. but it's sort of the thing. It also kind of relates to the watches too, right? In so many ways, it's like, you know, every watch, again, we, you know, so we brought some of my stuff. But you know, like those watches all have a story, you know, like they're all sort of connected to a particular moment or a thing or something, you know, something that happened, or, you know, again, sort of various stages in life where maybe you've achieved something and you're sort of like, well, you know what, I'm very passionate about timepieces. So why not, you know, try to take care of one.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm very much in that camp of like, I don't own those. Like, I'm just sort of like the caretaker for a certain period of time because they're going to move on.
Yeah.
I mean, most of them are all pre-owned anyways, which is cool, except for that Explorer.
Okay.
That was purchased from Rolex.
You know? There's a good story behind that watch, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a nice, yeah, it was a nice story only because it was like this, you know. And again, you know, what's actually really interesting too is that like every single one of those watches, like for the most part, I was like flat broke, right? So
yeah,
which is kind of like a
that's normal, a common watch guy thing, right?
It's, yeah, is it? I don't know, but I mean, it's for me, it's kind of like one of those things where you know, it's more symbolic of a particular accomplishment, and you know, it's again like I sort of define success, you know, in terms of like actually doing versus, you know, there's no financial connection to it. It's more about just doing. So like each one has like, I did that, you know?
Okay.
And so like, maybe I can take care of another one of those watches, which is kind of cool. But yeah, so the Rolex that was actually for my 35th birthday. I was with my wife and, in Paris, and I had talked about it because I think that one had just come out, the Explorer One, the new version, and so it was relatively new. So I, you know, in terms of its like kind of revamp, so I was sort of like, oh man, I want to just check it out. So I went there, sat down with them, and you know, again, like the store was empty. It was in Place Vendôme, so it was like very, very prestigious, you know, sort of environment. And so, yeah, like I sat down, they brought it out, we look at it. And then, you know, there's this moment where it's just like, oh, so is this a special occasion? I'm like, yeah, it's my birthday. They're like, oh shit. Like, it didn't say that, but they're like, but of course, shit.
It's the Rolex way, right?
Right. The Rolex way. And they brought out like, you know, the champagne and the this, and they even brought me this like little, I think I told you that, but they brought me this little box, you know, and that sort of mint colored packaging that they have, and it was really nice. And I opened it up, and this is before the purchase, right? So like none of that was so there was no commitment yet. And but it was a beautiful leather wallet, you know, from Rolex. And I know how collectible that stuff is. Like yeah. as time goes on, it's sort of like, you know, for sure. I remember that time when Rolex made those wallets. So they gave that to me. Again, with absolutely no commitment. And, you know, they're just like, all right, we'll see you later. And I'm just like, What are you kidding me? Like, all right, fuck it. Let's just buy this thing. So, but in order to like, to purchase a watch, typically, you know, something has to be sold. So like I've come in and out of stuff, you know, for years. So I'd always kind of like buy and sell and trade. And it was never really like, I could never really afford to, I could never afford to have like a collection, you know, but you know, those are the ones that have sort of like kind of stood the test of time. Sort of life matters, but they're all relatively special.
This week's episode is brought to you by Timex. I had the opportunity to sit down with Giorgio Galli, creative director for Timex Group, on the eve of the launch of the Giorgio Galli S1 Automatic, the brand's all-new automatic watch. He offered some great insights into the history of the brand and how the design came about. Here are a few snippets from our conversation. So how did you initially get into watches and then ultimately watch design?
I've been a designer and lover of watches for over 30 years. Italians love watches and I have a unique passion for it. I'm not sure why, but it's part of the culture. But my love for watches comes from my love and appreciation for design. Part of me always was interested in how we can make even a simple curve become a beautiful graphic element.
In your mind, what are the essential elements of a well-designed watch?
Proportion is so important, especially in watches. It's a small object, but it's also an intimate object. You wear it on your wrist and your skin, so find the correct proportion. It's absolutely critical.
Of all the brands you've designed for, what's distinct about Timex?
Well, I've been working for many brands in watches, but Timex definitely one of the brands I really like the most for a simple reason that it's a true brand, authentic. As an history that always fascinate me. The history of the brand build the story, so their cultural and historical part really helps to understand what you are looking at and what you're wearing. You know, so the product has a great influence from the past.
The S1 is such a distinct offering from Timex relative to many of the brand's other designs. What were your guiding principles for this project?
The S1 is a combination of my experience in designing watches, the DNA of the brand, and my view of what the watch should be. And I really wanted to create something timeless, which could have been designed 10 years ago or 10 years from now and still modern. There are not that many watches that have that timeless design. I mean, you see a lot of beautiful watches, but sometimes they're over-designed, it's overdone. The S1, I think, combine my view of how the watch should be and how actually it should relate to you.
For more on the Giorgio Galli S1 Automatic, visit timex.com. All right, let's get back to the show. So you've got, let's go through the box here. So we've got the Explorer and then we've got a Sub. Mm. Where does the Sub come from?
The sub was like, you know, that was actually something that I just wanted because I, you know, like it's one of those iconic pieces that you just, yeah, everybody, you know, all guys have to have a Sub. Now I've come in and out of various Rolexes before, but I never owned a Submariner. And so I thought it would be interesting to like, at least try to like, go back and or at least try to find one, you know. So I tried to find an older one. Mm. It's like a mid-90s and that was kind of banged up, and so I was able to get it to Rolex and then have it, you know, restored. And you know, they looked at it and they were like, you got to do this and this and that. And I was like, can we just do like half of that, you know? They're like, yeah, okay. So but yeah, so that one in particular was so that one and the Patek were both sort of purchased around the same time, which again, that was more equated to my 40th birthday.
Okay.
So I kind of like got to that point and I was okay. Sort of like, I'm going to do something special for it.
Yeah.
So, and of course I didn't stop. So yeah, so that happened.
And so the Patek is what you have on your wrist right now.
Yeah. That's the 5296.
Yeah.
With the sector dial.
It's a great watch.
Yeah, I'm going to take it off and just hand it over here to you. But yeah. There you go.
Yeah,
I know you've seen that.
I love this watch.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just so good.
Discontinued as relatively recently.
Yeah, not that long ago.
So you know, that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it was just really about the case size that sort of got me. I was kind of like, wow, I can actually like get a Patek that's, you know, got a little more meat to it, and you know,
yeah.
something I can wear, you know, almost every day without having to worry about it. Yeah. And again, for me, Patek is one of those, that's obviously, you know, okay, we just call it the best in the world, but you know, like it's more the history that's sort of, that always gets me, you know, and that's sort of that's where my appreciation to watchmaking, it really lies, is just the history and, you know, the stories of like how these companies came about and the technology and the attention to detail and the quality and all that is really, really the most important thing. So, but to own a Patek is obviously, take care of a Patek is actually really that's kind of the thing, you know, it's almost like it's a privilege just to sort of take care of this thing for a period of time and then pass it down. Yeah. And again, like, you know, I didn't know that Patek was Polish. Like that blew me away.
Yeah.
You know, like those are like one of those. Again, you know, when you dig into the history of all of that stuff, it's like, you know, Patek's Polish.
It's one of those companies that has such a strange kind of like meandering history. And today we think of it as this kind of like monolith, you know, same thing with Rolex. Like you think of Rolex and it's like, boom, it's Rolex. It was always there. It will always be there.
Yeah.
It's unchanging. It is what it is. And it's fun when you look into the history of these companies and you find the little things, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Cause I mean, they all have stories, you know, and these guys that established those companies, they were all out there, you know, hustling for a dream,
yeah,
you know, to make something happen.
Right.
You know, IWC is a great example of that too, you know? So, you know, it's just you have that sort of connection to it as like a New York City hustler.
Yeah.
You know, like trying to get your work made, and you know, like you can connect to a lot of the same stories that the founders had and the people that worked there. You know, it's special stuff, you know, and it's more than the object itself. That's sort of the thing that's always what gets me.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, one of the things I think, you know, kind of looking at these watches together is they're They're from historic brands. They're from brands that have real kind of like manufacturing know-how. You know, these aren't, you know, brands that are kind of buying in all their components and slapping a label on them. They all have a certain like cleanliness and clarity to them. You know, right. even the JLC Geographic is, considering sure. how much that watch does, it's extremely legible and, right. and kind of clean. The Portuguese chronograph, the Black Seal Panerai, like these are all like very clean, presentable watches. Is that something that happened purposefully, or is it just kind of a consequence of your taste?
Well, I guess both, right? Yeah, I mean, I've come in and out of different timepieces over the years, and you know, like over the years, you sort of start to, you know, figure out kind of like who you are as a person, and you start to realize like, wait a minute, you know, like, you know, this actually reflects more of like who I am and my personality. And again, guys don't have much to go on, you know what I mean? I'm not a big fashion person, so you know, like, I'm pretty much of a minimalist when it comes to that. So I'm like, you know, this sort of standard uniform of like, you know, black shirt, black top, black, you know, jeans, black boot. Like that's, you know, that's kind of it.
Yeah.
You don't have to think about it in the morning. So the only way you can kind of mix it up for me really honestly is really like the timepiece. So it's sort of like, well, I got that, you know? So ultimately this little collection that I have here is extremely edited, you know, over the years, and the design of each piece it is also edited in itself, you know, so it's really as sort of like as streamlined and basic as you can get. That's also something that I've loved about Patek, is that it's always very like subdued and subtle,
yeah,
quiet, humble, you know, like in all actuality, which I love, you know, which is just sort of like, you know, it's not about like, it's all about what's going on inside, you yeah. know. It's about the movement,
yeah.
ultimately, and the history behind the timepiece in itself. So it's like each piece that we have here on the table, ultimately you can start a conversation or have a conversation with somebody that maybe sort of noticed it and said, oh, that's a really nice watch you have. Well, and then you can open up this whole other world of, or at least sort of go in a direction of like bringing out the history and the story and the design and,
yeah.
you know, talking about the designer and just the history of the company and like who established what and whatever and how they all connect, you know, like, you know, did you know that this happened to that guy and that was, you know, like that's yeah. the fun stuff, you know, that you have. And I think that's sort of the beauty of history, you know, it's like, and again, like I see these pieces as sort of like these kind of like, you know, artifacts or encapsulations of like little pieces of history and that you can take with you. So they're cause sort of constant reminder of like, kind of like where things came from. You know, my father's actually like quite profound in terms of like his understanding of history. He's a bit of a historian himself. You know, the beauty about actually really understanding and appreciating history is that you can pretty much have a conversation with anybody in the world at any time, right? Like
yeah.
You can just bring up, you know, whether it's, you know, so, you know, so, you know, you're a cab driver from, you know, the Ukraine. It's like, well, if you know, you know, sort of contemporary Ukrainian history at the same time, I don't know why I'm bringing up Ukraine right now, but I think it's actually a true story that like my father was in a taxi and there was a Ukrainian driver. And so like, not only did he know the history of contemporary Ukraine, but he also knew about the sort of status and conditions that Ukraine went through during World War II, et cetera, and on into World War I or whatever. And so he was able to have this huge conversation with this cab driver, but it's just, you know, sort of goes to show you that like you can really, you know, find yourself at home anywhere in the world by understanding and appreciating history, which again, I see timepieces and watchmaking as reflective, you know, sort of that. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I mean, we experience it here all the time where you go somewhere and you notice somebody wearing a particular watch and, you know, okay, you go anywhere in the world and there are guys wearing Submariners, there are guys wearing, you know, Explorers. I'm wearing one today. But there are certain watches you see people wearing and you're like, oh, that guy's a watch guy. Like
Right.
Nobody would wear that watch.
Right.
Kind of unconsciously.
Right.
And so you immediately know you have something in common. And whether you start a conversation at the bar or not, wherever you are in the world, it is this kind of like silent nod that people can make to each other that like, even if we never talk, like we're in the same club.
Right. Yeah. Or at least have the same appreciation. Yeah. I mean, I typically will. So like normally like, people that own the Lange & Söhne, you know, like, because, I mean, that's a watch that nobody really, you know, I mean, in terms of mainstream.
Yeah, you don't accidentally end up with one.
Right, yeah. And honestly, like, it, just like Patek, it's like one of those timepieces you just do not, like, you're not seeing it every day, you know? Mm. And so it's kind of like scenes like a, you know, like a 250 California Ferrari, like driving down the street. It's like, you know, that doesn't happen. Maybe in California, but yeah, I mean, like if you have that moment where you're just sort of like subtly nod to the guy or girl that's wearing the Lange & Söhne, you're sort of like, that is dope shit.
Yeah.
Speaking of Vinny.
Yeah. So that's actually something I wanted to talk about. So we ended up getting introduced because Innie Archibong, who was on the show, we'll link up to Innie's show in the show notes here. When we asked Innie for his favorite bit of advice, it was from you, and it was show up, make dope shit.
Right.
Which is maybe the piece of advice I've heard from guests on this show that has resonated with me the most.
Right, where's that neon sign? We got to get that.
I know. We got to get one. Honestly,
get a neon sign and put that up.
I'll put it right above my desk. Right. It's just such like, it's such a good way to approach the world. And I think it speaks to a lot of people who are pursuing careers like you and very thankfully, and I feel very lucky to say this, like me, where like we get to do stuff we love every day and we get to wake up and try to like create stuff that makes people happy.
Yeah.
And it's just a good reminder that like, that stuff can all get very detail oriented and very stressful and just like any job, but ultimately just like show up and make dope shit. It's not that hard.
Right. Right. Well, but it is.
It's super hard. It's not hard as an approach. But it's super hard to execute.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of, you know, again, like I sort of reference my father again, but he, you know, he always said, you know, this notion of having vision, is extremely important. And, not everybody has it. It's sort of the difference between, being and doing, you know, it's sort of like, you know, are you understanding what your purpose is? Right. And like, and having, and taking it seriously, you know, and putting all of your energy into what it is that your purpose has been defined as, and you know, your purpose, you know, obviously sort of evolves over time, but as long as you can kind of stay focused and keep your ego in check, you know, the idea is that you can, you know, or you're always a student, you're always constantly pursuing and trying to learn as much as possible and evolve and reflecting on that is also extremely important as well. You know, like being able to spend time with yourself and like understanding sort of where you're at and where things are going. Something my grandfather said, and that one, that Technos there, that watch there, the old one, the one that stands out, the smaller one, that's actually my grandfather's watch.
That's super cool.
He was sort of famous for saying something like knowing where you're at. That's actually, that watch is actually kind of interesting because that one, that's sort of like my Pulp Fiction sort of reference, and that he was, you know, he's a, you know, career military soldier in the army, and he was stationed in Vietnam in the mid 60s. So I think I was talking to my father earlier, he was sort of around 66, 67 in Vietnam, and he purchased that watch in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And again, he's career, so he fought. He was in World War II, Korea, in Vietnam, when that was presented to my father via my grandmother and myself, you know, my father knew that I was taking care of watches, so he was just like, I want you to take care of this for me. Which was nice, but no, he did not wear it up his ass. But that, you know, Christopher Walken.
Like, but if anybody doesn't know what we're talking about, we will link that up also.
Yeah, but that's as close as it gets, you know. But it was sort of that story. It's like, you know, your father, he wore, yeah, your grandfather, he wore this up his ass. Like, my brother can do the impression way better than, but yeah, so. So that's a special piece that sort of stays in the collection, and that'll be passed down as well.
I mean, you mentioned a minute ago, and I you are absolutely right that, like, it is actually really hard to show up and make dope shit. So, like, yeah, you're somebody who makes stuff, right? Like, you have to come up with an idea and then find the right people, the right partners, the right place, the right materials to bring an idea into reality. And that's something that, you know, watches are a great kind of like representative of, right? Like, these are in some ways consumer goods, like a lot of the things we consume. They just happen to be extremely complex, highly engineered, very carefully made consumer goods. And it's like the amount of energy and effort that goes into bringing a watch from a sketchbook onto someone's wrist is immense. And do you think that your sort of background as a designer and an architect and a creator of things impacts and kind of like is part of your ability to like really appreciate these things?
100%. Yeah. I mean, that's where it really all came from. I was actually thinking about that just sort of, you know, kind of when we were first talking about that, when Innie introduced us and we were talking about doing this, I started reflecting a little bit on, like, you know, why watches, like, where did that come from? Obviously, there's some relationship to design and art. And so I spent some time thinking about it, and it was actually really interesting because I sort of started to understand that, yeah, of course, there's a design component, you know. I was also, you know, as a kid, you're kind of like into cars too, so you're sort of like, you know, automotive, and, you know, then, you know, obviously there's always some kind of like linkage between, like, you know, people are into cars and watches and, you know, this kind of stuff. So, but I was always very much into like the sort of like overall design of it, of the object itself. And so you know, so when people talk about, like, and I'm sorry, I'm going to go on just a little tangent. I'll bring it back. I'm going to bring it back. But the, like, you know, when people talk about, like, a Lamborghini as like a car, you know, like, I'm thinking Bertone, you know, like, I'm thinking about the design house or the styling house of the car, you know, where or originated. Or when people speak about Ferrari, I'm thinking of Pininfarina. Yeah. You know, like just that's sort of where my head was at. And so, yeah. And then that sort of segued also into, you know, again, like, just, you know, just design in general. And I spent some time, you know, but it was, as a kid, I was just radically fascinated with timepieces, just inherently, you know.
So you've been a watch guy forever.
That is, you know, that was really an honest answer. I was trying to think, like, was there like a moment? And I just remember, like, my mother taking me to the grocery store in Maryland, outside of D.C., Washington, D.C., and I would, there was, like, this little jewelry store next, like, down, like, on the strip mall, you know, and they had Rolex in the window, and I always would sort of gravitate to the window, and I would just be looking at the watches.
Some people are just pulled to it, man.
I was just pulled to it, but I can argue this, too, that this is kind of sort of another sort of interesting thing is that, like, as I got into, like, as a teenager, I remember reading this article about time and time management. It was an article, I think it was in GQ, it was called The Luxury of Time. And the luxury of time meant, you know, it's just sort of like, you know, using time as a commodity, and like, time is the most valuable thing that we have. So, like, we should be, you know, working towards trying to gain as much time as possible for us. And I don't know what it was, but I think, you know, a lot of this always stuck in my head. And so time as a concept became really important to me. And I'm gonna bring this full circle in a second. But, like, I remember, so when I started in college in architecture, and then moving up to New York, this is, let's say, 2000, 2001. So I was about, like, you know, around 20, 21, 22, like that time period, you know, in architecture, you know, at Parsons was pivotal for me in terms of this, the notion of time, because like there was this moment in architecture in the 80s, late 80s and 90s that was, you know, regarded as deconstructivism, and deconstructivism sort of evolved into this other thing called morphology in architecture. But it was all time-based. It was all about perception. It was all about awareness of space and how spaces, you know, so Bernard Schumi wrote this, like, you know, pivotal sort of manifesto and book, which was all rooted in philosophy from France, which was Jacques Derrida and Gilles Deleuze. And their understandings of time really influenced the sort of deconstructivist movement. Mm. Which again was about sort of breaking down spaces and program and sort of finding those sort of collision moments or the points of inflection being these sort of moments of becoming. Moments of becoming is sort of this something that we live with every day, which is like that moment when, you know, you might intersect with somebody and then your entire life changes. Or space, you know, these two things come together and then everything sets off in a different trajectory. So in short, I mean, like, basically, like, this was fascinating to me, and I just dug into this stuff, and it was really about, it was always about time. And I was like thinking to myself, man, this is, you know, like, this is me, and this, I absolutely love this. So I started going further and further, and what you can find, how that evolves is essentially like you're understand, like when you get into the time thing, you're kind of like, okay, well, what is, so then you start going back to the ancient Greeks, mm-hmm. and you start looking into, like, you know, Zeno and, like, you know, all Plato and like their understandings of time. And then obviously it goes into Einstein himself. And then, you know, I mean, it was just on and on and on. And then, like, this is all through kind of like grad school, you know, the earlier years of architecture study. And then again, like, one of the things that Schumi was really passionate about too was sort of like understanding, you know, architecture and time and perception based on film, you know, so it was like film studies and like getting into film studies. And so, like, watching films by like Chris Mark or like La Jetée or even Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, which is really kind of like the sort of like mainstream version of like how the deconstructivists were kind of like putting together film, like breaking down space and time and nonlinear thinking. Right. So, I don't know, all that really influenced me. And that ultimately kind of led back to this understanding of like the space in between, like that between like two things, like between me and this microphone, it's kind of like, well, the space in between there's a dialogue happening. But that space in between is that space of becoming, which again was sort of like pivotal for Schumi's work and the deconstructivists. But like, I was thinking, well, you know, I'm fascinated by that. I'm also fascinated by design. But like, you know, as we were talking about earlier, like this idea of the byproduct, like what if the design that was produced was really like from that in-between dialogue, you know? So that's where the byproducts come up, you know?
Okay.
Like, so producing design that sort of engages, I like to call it sort of relational design.
You know?
So this idea of relational design was really about producing, if you were to design something, it would be more of a byproduct of a relationship. So that was kind of where that landed. But anyway, the short of that is that, you know, like you can see that as an example. It's like, just try to give you a quick example. But like, if you see like the edge of the chair, it's like, if you're going to design, you know, something like a table that would, you know, so basically like, what's the relationship between that table and this chair? Like right now there are two different things, like that's A and that's B. But the space in between, it's like, could you design a piece of furniture that would relate directly to the chair? Or the chair relating directly to the table.
Okay. Yeah.
So there's like a fusion.
Right.
You know,
that
and
makes
that's,
sense.
That's kind of where the morphology comes in. It's sort of like this sort of symbiotic or systemic relationship.
Yeah.
You know, between the two, and that they are all connected.
Is there an example of your work that you think embodies that? Like something you've created that kind of like perfectly sums that up for you, where you were like, yes, like I nailed it. Like I got it. Yeah. The ideas are there. It's right.
Yeah. And it not like it was. Yeah. So for Moroso, the table, the Mark table, which is not named after me, the Mark table was named after the owner of the restaurant and bar that was called the Mark. But the, yeah, the Mark table was an example of that because it was really, it was, the table was designed as a byproduct specific to the seating system that was designed. Okay. So the seating, which was the space. So the seating had a relationship to the space had a relationship to the seating had a relationship to the smaller objects in the table. And so really the table was, essentially a silhouette of the seating system itself. So it was almost just, again, that became that byproduct. Okay. And that's kind of where that sort of, that was the first sort of manifestation of like, oh wow. You know, like that, that, that was it. And then that was picked up by the MoMA. So the MoMA, you can buy that table at the MoMA store. So, $399.
That's all right. You're allowed to plug.
$399.
All good.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll link it up so that people can see it too. Mm. Are there other ways that that idea has carried through to other work, work you've done more recently, or has your sort of general thinking evolved away from that?
No, I mean, no, every day because basically the way I like to understand it is in just in terms of like, you know, in terms of space, you know, it's all about your body in relationship to the space itself, you know. Sort of one of the things that, and I can, I'll give you an example of this in a second, but like one of the things that sort of like, bothers me currently right now with the state of architecture, since I got a mic and you've got an audience,
that's what we're here for, man. Rants are my favorite.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of these moments where, you know, we're just spent so much time looking at, the formal, gestures of these buildings. And, you know, it's really like, you know, how do we commodify, is that a word?
Yeah, that's a word. That counts.
We could commodify, you know, the sort of commodification of architecture, you know, the sort of Bilbao effect of like, you know, shiny tinsel, that's being used to essentially like, you know, sell space and buildings to the highest bidder or whatever. And, you know, and again, we're spending so much time looking at them from the outside when architecture is really about space. Architecture is about the interior. It's about moving through space and your relationship with space and how that makes you feel. And ultimately it should make you feel, or at least sort of raise the spirit. You know, Louis Kahn was the best at that, in my opinion. Tendai Ando is also another, you know, master of this. But this idea that we're spending so much time looking at the outside versus the inside, and again, let's parallel think back to watches. You know, it's not about how many diamonds you have on your Audemars Piguet. You know, we've tend to sort of lost our sort of a track in terms of like where the value of this watch is. No, it's about the history of the watch. You know, like most of these guys don't even know that, you know, it was designed off the portal of the, you know, the Royal Oak. You know, like,
yeah,
or you know what I mean, Genta and like his work with Patek and also with Audemars Piguet. It's like it's not about that. It's about, you know, all the engineering and the design and the work in the history of the company that goes into like the production of that and what that means. You know, culturally, and so recently, just to go back to your question, you know, we've been working on, you know, designing these sort of like minimalist cabins. And, you know, we produced this first one as a prototype, you know, in upstate New York, not too far, about 2 hours. But I mean, in essence, like the idea is that, you know, the building needed to be as humble as possible. It's almost like it doesn't even exist. So, you know, there's like one entire facade of the building, which is just low profile building, which again, I've sort of called the edifice, which again has there's no fenestration, there's no windows, nothing, you know, but what it does is that wall sort of offers itself up to allowing the light and shadow to sort of dance on the facade of the building, which makes the building in so many ways disappear, you know.
Yeah.
The building vanishes in the certain light of the day, as you know. So back to relational design, the building is has a relationship directly with the environment, and not only just like the physical environment, but, you know, with, we could argue, cosmos and like the movement of the sun and the moon and like how it relates specifically in connection also to the trees and the leaves of the trees. And so, in addition to the fact that like the building is completely off grid, meaning, or calling introverted architecture a neo-transcendentalist, but like this idea that the building, the systems of the building, the infrastructure of the building, is completely self-sustaining, meaning that it's operating completely on solar. There's composting, the wood burning stove, so your heat comes from the wood around, you know, which you got to work for, which Claire knows very well. So that's my wife. So she works very hard for that wood. And thank you for the hatchet. And so get to work. And so, but I mean, yeah. So, I mean, essentially in essence, like those systems are all integrated into the building itself and self-sustaining. So yeah, it's not the most shiny piece of design, you know, that's going to get the cover of whatever magazine, but it's not supposed to, you know.
Yeah.
It's supposed to just, you know, do what it needs to do in relationship to that environment. And it makes you feel something, you know.
Yeah.
You almost feel the humility of it, you know, when you approach it. You're sort of like, oh, was that it? But then there's sort of moments where it opens itself up spatially and you're engaged with it, and it's unique. It's almost like taking this Patek, and, you know, which is a very, you know, streamlined, edited, minimal watch, and then turning it to the back and it's got this other thing going on.
Yeah.
You know, this whole other world. And so that's sort of where I like to kind of, at least that's sort of where I like to kind of take the direction of the work that we're doing right now. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's
heavy.
Would you ever want to design a watch, or do you think that would kind of like maybe ruin it for you?
I'm doing it right now, man.
You're doing it?
Designing a watch right now. No. but while we're talking, I'm designing. No. No, absolutely. I mean, I would 100% love to do that. You know, and again, like we were talking, like we're always talking, it's about relationships. So it's really about, you know, one day, you know, if there's somebody or something that happens, that'd be amazing. Speaking of watches that are being designed, I was with Joe Doucet the other day, and again, Joe's another watch guy designer.
Yeah,
and he. And he brought him up last time too when he was on it. And yeah, but Joe's working on a new watch, which is actually really cool.
I didn't know that. That's awesome.
So I think, he said sometime in, I think in May,
okay,
he might be launching that. So
very cool.
But he showed me some renderings of it, which is really, really cool.
Very cool. I'm always glad to hear when good designers are designing watches.
Yeah, when good designers.
so much of watch design is it's clearly designed by committee. Right? Like it's designed by focus grouping and, you know, market testing and whatever. And you can always tell. Like I think most people these days are smart enough and savvy enough that they can, when they have a product in their hands, they can tell if it has like authorship to it. Right. Did this come out of one or two people's brains as something they felt strongly about? Or was this designed so that I would buy it?
And right.
I think people are getting pretty savvy to it, and I don't know. I find the reactions I hear from, you know, folks here at Hodinkee, and then, you know, also just friends who are interested in watches, furniture, or whatever.
Right.
I think I'm hearing those reactions, and people get it.
Well, you know, the same thing happens in design and architecture itself. I mean, and that's also sort of like one of the things that I kind of like sort of bothers me in terms of when people start talking about like using the label as designer or what have you. It's you know, and I'm kind of, again, like leaning more towards this sort of art thing. It's just that, you know, I think that this whole idea of design by committee is sort of also, or like, you know, this design using data and algorithms and, you know, all sorts of systems and, you know, like strategy. It's like, they're like 50 strategists in the room and we've got all this data. You know, of like, you know, this is the way to design space now. And so, like, I think that design is, that the word design is also being hijacked in so many ways by certain groups and companies that are kind of like using that word as like, oh, we're designers because, you know, we've got like computers that tell us what to do or how to design. And I think that's total bullshit. You know,
do you think there's like a way to take that back? Do you think that word can kind of be like co-opted, or do you think that ship sailed?
You build a cabin in the woods and you write a manifesto. That's kind of how it kind of boils down to.
All right.
Or nobody's getting bombed, but like the idea is that like you're out there like kind of like, well, no, but the
screaming at the stars.
The building in itself is really the question. It's sort of like, what does this mean in relationship to like this other stuff? You know, it's like every time you do something, you're creating a conversation ultimately, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at least I think you should, you know, like I think, you know, that's sort of the value. And I think the point of at least like really good design at least poses a little bit of a question to something else, you know? So you're again, creating a dialogue. That kind of stuff really bothers me. And I just think that, you know, we're living in a world today that's just like so overly saturated with like, you know, just that big data. You know, just it's too much, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I just recently deleted all of my social apps on my phone. Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, because it's sort of like, and I really sort of urge everybody to kind of do that because, you know, it's just, it's killing us, you know, like as a society, and we got to move on, or at least kind of simplify and get back to basics. Which again is sort of like, that's sort of the beauty of the timepiece of the watch. You know, it's sort of like, this is as basic as it can get.
Yeah.
You know, I personally feel like smart watches are the sort of antithesis to, you know, this sort of, you know, it's the sort of humanity or essentials of the timepiece. You know, when I explain to people, like, you know, certain people ask, they'll ask me, you know, people that understand or know watches, like, how does that work? You know? And it's like, oh yeah, you've got a mainspring and it beats like a heart, you know? It's like, it's living. It's a living technical organism.
It blows,
you know,
people's minds blows when people's they first minds. Hear it. Yeah. It blows their minds.
They just don't understand, like, to wrap their head around. And like, this stuff was basically invented back in the 1700s or, you know, on that scale. So it's like, it puts everything in perspective, you know, and that's something where, again, with the proper timepiece, you're also making a statement of, at least it is for me. It's like, I'm making a statement that I see and feel and understand my relationship to the sort of essentials of humanity and life in general versus, you know, this all this other noise that's around us. You know?
No, so. I totally, totally agree.
Right. And I think that's also the beauty of Houdinki itself is that, you know, you put that on, you know, a platform and a stage where, you know, like it has a voice.
Well, thank you.
And it keeps going.
We try. I mean, it's certainly a nice way to connect with people. I mean, I've met more interesting people through connecting over these little mechanical things than probably any other way in my life. And it's a pretty exciting thing.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's all over the planet and people from all walks of life. And it's a cool thing to kind of meet and share lives for a little bit over these things.
100%. You know, I mean, it's definitely something that's unique and special that needs to be preserved and cultivated, you know, for our own sake.
Yeah.
You know,
no question.
You know, it's kind of like, it's like cooking, you know, it's sort of like, you know, we don't want to stop, you know, actually making meals for our families. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I mean, and in so many ways we have, you know, and I think, you know, again, like, you know, writers like Michael Pollan who are advocates of like, you know, getting back to basics and cooking your own meals and like, you know, going and spending time and, you know, at the farm and like trying to do the most you can to like, you know, stay connected and back to, you know, nature is really the most important thing. And, you know, and again, like, you know, these timepieces, they represent that as well, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think your appreciation for that makes a lot of sense, and the importance you place on that makes a lot of sense, considering you're a person who makes things from beginning to end, right? Like, you yeah. have an intimate understanding, and we touched on it earlier, but like, you have an intimate understanding of how a thing goes from an idea to a thing on a shelf or at a store that you can buy. And most people don't. It's just like a consequence of the capitalism that we live in. Like, most people just, stuff is on shelves and they have no idea how it got there, whether it's a watch or a chair or a piece of food, whether it's a piece of fruit or a cut of meat. People have no idea how it gets there.
Right.
And, you know, I think, you know, I'll speak for myself, is I find that when you understand those pathways, things have much more meaning, because you understand those stories, you understand where they come from. You know, they're imbued with a whole lot more than they are when they're just a thing with a price tag on it.
100%.
And it makes things much more fun. Yeah, I mean, it sounds very serious, but ultimately it just makes life more enjoyable. Like, I find I have more fun and enjoy things a lot more when I know where they come from and why they're there.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and everything in your house should have a story, ultimately. I mean, that's sort of the beauty of, you know, again, like, yeah, for me, it's like one of those, it's a constant, as a young designer, and maybe this is sort of like speaking to young designers now, it's like you're coming out of school, you're trying to figure out your voice or your position as a designer. But we're talking about industrial design or product design or, you know, what have you. It's one of those issues that you have to ask yourself, like, do we need this? Like, do we need another chair? Do we need another table? Do we need, you know? And so, and it is a struggle. It's sort of like, well, if I am going to design this, there needs to be a reason, you know, there needs to be a purpose. Now, there might be a commission, for example, by, you know, a certain client that might call upon you to design something specific. That's one thing that sort of, again, can fall into the sort of realm of, like, you know, the commission, you know, to the artist. But to sit around and kind of like try to come up with more stuff for the sake of making things to sell, just to sell, that's not where I'm at. You know, like, I'm really in that sort of moment where I was like, you know, like late 20s and through my 30s, it was really about like, oh, I've got a few ideas where I'm actually trying to articulate something, have a conversation with, and develop those relationships with X, Y, Z, you know, and try to get those things produced as reflecting or embodying something that I felt was important. And then that's it, you know, sort of like, well, you should say, okay, well, you know what, like, I'm going to leave it at that. Now, if there's certain commissions that come in and you say, well, yeah, okay, well, what are we doing here? What are we saying? How are we doing that? That's a different story. But ultimately it's like, you know, you have to be very conscious, especially, you know, right now environmentally as well. It's sort of like, you know, what are we doing? You know, like, what's, where are we at when it comes to that? So, you know, my, yeah, I mean, like, some of the new stuff that we're going to be working on currently right now, again, all sort of relates directly to sustainability, the ecology of, you know, sort of like the sort of like bigger picture in terms of like where these things come from and what's their life cycle, et cetera. You know, I mean, but that should be the normal dialogue now that's happening, you know, in design. And what that, you know, where that can go, you know, there's a lot to be done with that, which is really cool. So it's like a whole new world that's opening up in terms of like how we can, produce and make things that, you know, that will, you know, ultimately help, you know.
That's awesome.
So there's, well, where we are. Where are the beers, by the way?
I don't know. Well, I think we'll go get those now. Thanks for coming on, man. This is great. I know we've been talking about doing this for a while, and you know, Innie set us up basically immediately after he got off mic. So
right on.
Maybe we'll have to have both of you guys back. We'll do a joint episode.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Actually, you know, Innie's actually going to be here next week. He's going to be here next week. So we should try to.
Let's try to make that happen.
Yeah, I think he's like Sunday through Tuesday or something.
Okay.
Like that, so,
sweet.
You know, right on.
Awesome, dude. Yeah, thanks, man. So much. Good to see you, and thanks for joining us.
No, thank you, man. This is great. This is awesome.
This week's episode was recorded at Hodinkee HQ in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate this show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.